Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy today to be speaking with Winona LaDuc. Winona LaDuc is a Native American of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabe. She lives and works at the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, where she's founding director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project and also program director of Honor the Earth. She's a graduate of Antioch and Harvard Universities and writer of many articles and several books. The most recent books are All Our Relations, which is about Native environmental struggles, and the Winona LaDuc Reader. Winona LaDuc also ran as the vice presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket in the 2000 elections. So I want to welcome you, Winona, and if you would tell us about... and I forgot to mention that you're the mother of three kids, one of them just 2 years old, and so you're really busy doing many projects, and whatever's on the top that you'd like to talk about would be just great.
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity to visit with you here. I want to talk about this wild rice issue. Monominikegesis, that's what they call this in Minnesota. In the Great Lakes area, it's the wild rice moon. And that's an issue of wild rice is something that we're working on in Minnesota because of the conflicts with present-day trade agreements and biocolonialism as it affects our rice crop. Our communities were given wild rice by the Creator. It's Monomin itself means kind of like the good seed, the gift of the Creator. It's in part of our migration story. We're instructed to travel to the place where the food grows upon the water, which would be wild rice. And that is what we did. So that is the only place in the world that wild rice grows naturally, and it grows on lakes and in streams, and it is the bounty of the Great Lakes region, and it has sustained our communities for thousands of years. Our communities have always harvested that rice. You go out in a canoe, two people go out, one pulls and one knocks. And we collect the rice and bag it and bring it in and parch it over a fire and winnow it. And that is how it has been done for a very long time. We continue that practice. But the problems we are facing now, about 20 years ago is when the big problems started, where the University of Minnesota started researching and figured out how to domesticate the wild rice, was successful in beginning to grow it in rice paddies in Minnesota. Declared it the state grain, and only a couple of years later, California became the largest wild rice producing state, which is what you got up by Chico.
Yeah, I've noticed, because when I was a child, we ate wild rice. I'm from Illinois, and we ate wild rice from Minnesota, and I was even explained to me about how Native American people picked it and all that, and now I see it all over the place. Yeah. It was very rare then.
No, that's exactly right, and you know, we maintain it's not the same thing. We call that tame rice. I mean, it's grown in a diked rice paddy. It's and harvested with a combine. Doesn't taste like a lake. A lot of times, you know, in Minnesota at least, they have to use a lot of chemicals. I don't know exactly what they use out here on it. I'm trying to actually research that a little bit more. But, you know, one of the things I do know is one of the problems is they burn off the crop and usually put in two crops a year, which has to do a lot with greed. Causes a lot of air pollution, silica up in the sky. But our problems are is that the California paddy wild rice industry has misrepresented its crop. It sold as wild rice, shouldn't be, and it's devastated our economies on our reservations, where you used to be able to get a good price for your rice, and Indians controlled most of the wild rice market, and most of our people being pretty low income, you know, it really helped them out a lot, particularly around school clothes and you know, things like that in the fall, you know, winter boots for your kids. because you could make a good income ricing, you know. Now what's happened is that, you know, you cannot get a good price because you're competing against a combine in California. That's kind of the start of the problem. In the past couple of years, it's gotten worse. University of Minnesota completed the map of the genome of wild rice about 2 years ago, which in this era is something you don't want to happen, because once they map it is when they start mucking around with it. And so now we're faced with some Australian researchers that are bombarding wild rice genes from our rice into white rice and then in reverse as well.
Is this what you call genetically modified?
Mm-hmm. GMO work on rice and transgenetic work. You know, and that's what we're concerned about, because it could contaminate our rice genome. And as everyone knows, with like the situation of corn, GMO corn, you know, our rice is very diverse. There's short rice and long rice. It comes in at different times on your lakes, in your creeks. So there's always a rice crop. Genetic manipulation and domestication are about creating monocultures, not about creating diversity. Because that's what you need for mechanization, is non-shattering, you know, monoculture varieties. And we're afraid that it could contaminate our crops and we would lose our biodiversity, which would be devastating to, you know, our people, but obviously to all the wildlife in the region, which also relies upon it. The other thing we're concerned about, deeply concerned about, is that a California company named NorCal Wild Rice up near Davis, California, has patented a breeding process of wild rice, where they've created a cytoplasmic male sterility, and or they patented a process, and we're concerned about patenting. Because I believe, you know, probably like a lot of other folks, that patents are for toasters and gadgets and should not be for life. And so, you know, we're concerned about the patents, we're concerned about the political implications. So what I do, you know, what we're doing in our region, we brought together and met with a lot of the tribes in the region, and so most of the tribes in our region, I think we have 19 resolutions from most of tribal communities on the U.S. side. We're moving into Canada now to oppose both the genetic work on wild rice and the patenting, you know, because it's an issue. It's called biocolonialism, you know, where the remaining genetic reservoirs of diversity are largely indigenous communities, and there's no justice between the seed companies, by and large, or the human genome diversity, you know, project, all these projects, and they come in to mine the genetic resources of Indian country.
Yeah, it's really ghoulish. Really, I can't think of any other way to put it. It's so terrible, and of course it affects everybody ultimately, some people more than others more quickly, but all this stuff is in the web of life.
You know, there are things to do about it. A lot of the people who probably listen to this program buy at food co-ops. It's a fair trade issue. They should carry lake-harvested rice, not paddy-grown rice. It's a huge issue to our communities. You know, go out there on the web, you know, Leech Lake Band, Native Harvest, that's us. You know, a lot of our communities market that rice and it makes a big difference, mm-hmm, to our communities. And if you're going to pay that much a pound, you should get the real thing.
Yeah. Say the names again of the names of the rice that you harvest.
Well, Native Harvest is one brand, Leech Lake Tribe. You know, I'm going to give you a website if people are interested in this campaign. The other thing is that we're challenging the patents is what we're looking to do, which is what, you know, kind of following the lead of the Indians from India and their challenges on the neem patent that W.R. Grace proposed and the basmati rice patent challenges. Indigenous people kind of on a worldwide scale are challenging these patents and, you know, these issues, which are, you know, the issues of GATT and TRIPS, in international trade agreements, and very much also the issues of who has the right to control seeds and who has the right to control life. Our website is www.welrp.org, and we're updating our web page and on the campaign on wild rice.
Yeah, and we're going to give the website again in a little while, so if you didn't catch it then.
Yeah. No, WELRP, White Earth Land Recovery Project, you know, WELRP. .org or nativeharvest.org, mm-hmm, is the other one, and both of those have information about the campaign on it. And you know, so I'm passing that information on. I know it doesn't affect everybody maybe, but it is kind of a microcosm of these issues of who gets to control life, who gets to control seeds. And it's very much a California issue because the biopiracy, You know, the stealing of the seeds and the stealing of the life forms have occurred in California agriculture, which is no surprise, you know. Mm-hmm. Plus, they're growing a crop that's an aquatic crop in a desert, which has, you know, got its own share of problems. So.
Yeah, and these are really international issues, too. Mm-hmm. And not only are seeds patented and genes from indigenous people, from right. all kinds of people, but genes, there's this, we could probably spend the whole program on this issue.
Yeah, but there's been a lot of successful work. I mean, there's still researchers here in the Bay Area that are trying to push ahead with work around the Human Genome Diversity Project. But, you know, they were denied major funding internationally, largely because of the outcry of Native communities and the blanket opposition of Native communities to this issue of Human Genome Diversity Project going out and trying to find the markers for the map of the human genome and taking blood and tissue samples from indigenous communities. You know, largely, you know, non-consensually, or just these huge issues of, you know, as you know, I mean, the issues that communities need inoculations or basic dental care, not someone to come spend a lot of money taking blood and tissue samples and then turning around and, you know, the U.S. Department of Health patenting them.
And they do it in a sneaky way. Sometimes they say they're doing these good things, but in fact, they're taking gene samples. Yeah.
But that's the Indigenous Peoples Project on biocolonialism. Mm-hmm. Deborah Harry, you know, if you ever run into her, she's the one who's done a lot of work on that, really excellent work in that, you know. We've just been thankful to know her.
Well, there's so many issues, of course, Winona LaDuke. There's some, as you put it, this distancing from the earth, and particularly for Native people, of course, who've been Native people everywhere, who've been living the most close to, harmoniously with the earth, and that's part of your whole mindset. So there have been so many horrible effects from this.
Well, you don't want to over-romanticize our communities. What you should say is that, I mean, I would phrase it is that land-based communities are impacted by a resource intensive society. Those are indigenous communities, are largely the land-based. I mean, it's the economics of, if you're going to consume a third of the world's resources, you know, near the United States, you're going to have to take that from someplace, and it's going to require a constant intervention into other countries, whether it's in the Gulf War, or whether it's in, you know, wherever, you know, in Central America, you know, Colombia. It's going to require a constant intervention into other people's countries and a constant violation of other people's human rights, you know, to keep up that level of consumption. And the people who remain on that land are quite often the indigenous communities.
And they're getting more and more squeezed. Why do you think they want to get these genes?
Because, you know, indigenous communities have the biodiversity or the genetic diversity. You know, they say we're like 99% the same, everybody, or whatever. But that remaining distinction is very significant in terms of a lot of health issues. And it's largely the health issues of, I don't want to say of privilege, but, you know, a lot of the genetic work is about the health issues of privilege, you know, cures for cancer instead of cures for malaria or TB, you know, because what is affecting the vast majority of the world's populations are diseases which are preventable, that they need inoculations for. But, you know, what affects this country is questions of, like, you know, heart conditions, obesity, diabetes, a lot of issues that are related to having too much.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times they don't need inoculations. They need better diets, clean water. I mean, a lot of the world. And I noticed it said that you have a diabetes project.
Yeah. Where did you find all this stuff? That's pretty interesting. I don't know where all this stuff's on the web. That's right. We have, it's called Minomejum. You know, our project, Native Harvest, produces a lot of food and markets a lot of food, but we realized that our community needed far more of our own food. And so we have 175 elders, families, that are given food every month. That's traditional foods, because that is actually the best cure for diabetes. We have epidemic rates of diabetes in our Indian communities, and those foods are your medicine. That combined with exercise. Mm-hmm. So that's been a lot of our work.
A lot of these things are like these fancy ways of healing things. Well, so when you say about the privilege, I think there's a lot to that, because a lot of times it's about making money and the things that they're going to come up with. These pharmaceutical companies and everything are going to actually probably cost a lot of money.
No, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That genome project is about, you know, creating drugs that'll, you know, I mean, because, like, you know, I was always joking with my Native Hawaiian friends, but you know, a lot of Inuit and Hawaiian people have facial fat. I don't know how to say it. That means that they look young longer. Now, that's a gene, you know. And so, you know, in the age when you're inserting botulism into your cheeks to make sure you don't get wrinkled, you know, that is, I mean, that is what that is about. You know, obviously there's more significant health circumstances that it is about, but the fact that, I probably shouldn't have said that on the air out here in California, but it's true that, you know, that a lot of these communities, because of their genetics, they don't age so rapidly because they have more, you know, chubbier cheeks and, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know.
Uh-huh. So they'll probably fit that into some kind of cream and sell it for a huge amount of money.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly right, you know, or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. Well, with Nona LaDuca, what other kinds of things are especially on your mind these days? As
like
I say,
energy policy. Yeah, you know, energy policy in the United States is bad. I was laughing on my way over because I, you know, this magazine, The Onion. Mm-mm. You never seen The Onion? It's like a college weekly. I think it's a weekly that comes out, and it's totally a mock of the news. You should really check this out. You can get it on the internet, on The Onion. I was reading The Onion, it was about a year ago, and I read this article. I didn't know it came, someone had forwarded it to me about, and the story was that that Gale Norton, that there was this new discovery announced by the Bush-Cheney administration that there's a large coal deposit on the backside of Mount Rushmore, and that they are planning to go out there and, you know, the BLM was going to do a bunch of investigations, and then, you know, Gail Norton was saying, well, there isn't anything in a president's cranium anyway. We're going to go, you know, they're going to go dig out the back of the president's heads on Mount Rushmore. And I thought it was true, you know, because the energy policy is so bad in the United States. I thought they probably did find a big coal deposit on the backside of Mount Rushmore. But, you know, it wasn't.
For those who don't know, Mount Rushmore is carved with the heads carved of presidents long ago.
Oh, the atrocity in the middle of the Black Hills. But anyway, what I'm saying is that, I mean, and that is not news to you, Sue. It's just, you know, the horrific, you know, the, you know, Bush energy policy, which is, you know, so backwards. First, the passage of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, you know, bad, bad law, moving 90,000 shipments of nuclear waste to Yucca Mountain, you know. I mean, what is the solution to nuclear waste problem? The solution is you don't make more. You turn off the faucet before you know, before, to keep the thing from flooding, you know, which is where we're at now. We've got the bathtub keeps flooding because, you know, you don't turn off the faucet, and we enable it. I mean, the government's going to enable more nuclear. They're trying to enable it. You know, we're going to fight them, obviously, but, you know, and you don't move 90,000 shipments. You look towards the alternatives, and, you know, obviously those alternatives are so available. I was talking to these Indian tribes from the Great Plains, and there's 23 Indian reservations in the Great Plains that together have 350 gigawatts, which is an immense amount of wind energy, you know, potential. And they are putting up wind generators right now, you know, out there like on the Rosebud Reservation, three affiliated tribes, you know, is putting them up, Standing Rock. You know, a bunch of these different reservations, the Blackfeet, you know, have like five generators up. And those, that is energy justice. That is what an energy policy should be about. Because, you know, put those things up, you have some capital costs at the front end, and guess what? You don't have to pay for your fuel after that. You don't have to get in a war to go get fuel from anybody. You're set. The wind's going to keep blowing. You know, so long as the wind is blowing, you're good. And all you got to do is get it to market. They say that the Great Plains is the Saudi Arabia of wind power. You know, could produce half of present U.S. electrical consumption right out of the Great Plains. You know, what you got to do is both unclog the power lines from coal, which are clogged up, which, you know, is producing so much CO2 emissions. And the other thing is that you probably have to build some more power lines, which, you know, I'm not a proponent of power lines, but, you know, between those two, because the infrastructure in this country for electrical production and distribution is skewed towards big power plants, not skewed towards setting up wind generators that you can feed into from small farms or, you know, Indian communities across the country. You know, it's called like an underline. I always think of like, it's called an underwire. Like, it's like an underwire bra. That's how I remembered it. Like that they feed up in the power line. So it's not just distributing, it's also feeding in. And, you know, we could have an energy justice in terms of energy policy in this country. That's what 1 year after 9/11 we should be talking about is, you know, and that's what, of course, George W. should be saying is, you want to be patriotic? Produce energy. Mm-hmm. Produce energy in like that.
Yeah, and as you say, it's also totally doable. There's no question about it. Well, that's interesting about that. The Great Plains could make half of the energy needed for the United States. Electricity. Electricity.
And then you got to cut a few SUVs out. I was riding over to my friend's house behind all those guys going to the Raider games. All those guys that are going to the Raider games in those pickup trucks and SUVs, do they really need those pickup trucks and SUVs?
Probably not.
You know, I mean, you know, there's a lot, obviously fuel efficiency. There's an immense amount that, you know, California is the perfect example of it. I mean, but, you know, or both fuel efficiency and all those things on biofuels and biodiesel. And he's telling me that I could just go down to the McDonald's, get the used grease, and turn it into power for my car. If I had a diesel-based car, I was like, I could do that. I mean, there's the number of McDonald's in this country is those in Walmarts. You could probably fuel about a third of the progressive movement in this country with the the grease.
Absolutely. And, you know, many people don't have the information about this. We're lucky that we get it here with the Ecology Center and a lot of things that go on in Berkeley, but this is not a real typical community. I know that hemp is another good way. I mean, hemp has so many, many uses. And I know on the Pine Ridge Reservation, there were some people growing hemp, industrial hemp, and they got, I don't know what the latest is on that, but the federal government came in the middle of the night with their helicopters and took it all away.
Yeah, they got kind of, I think I say Unkshla or Gitamagas is how we'd say it in Ojibwe, kind of a pitiful crop, you know, this year because the government seized it. Alex Whiteplume family. You know, it's ironic, single poorest county in the country, Shannon County, and they, Pine Ridge Reservation decriminalizes industrial hemp. I didn't really notice the federal government cared anything about drugs in Indian country or alcohol in Indian country or anything else in Indian country. They pretty much turned blind eyes, so I don't know why it would make any difference to the DEA, aside from the fact that the guy is growing industrial hemp, and you have to smoke an entire bale to get high. You know, but the government has seized it from this family out there who's just, you know, poorest darn county in the country, and they're trying to do something for alternative, you know, for alternative out there.
Right, and they live in houses made out of hemp, and you can use hemp for
hemp. There's a hemp house out there.
Yeah.
No, there's not
one.
Hemp houses. There's one hemp house out there made in Slim Butte area of that reservation. Very, you know, very nice. You know, there's a lot of options for that hemp, though. That is for sure, and I'm a big proponent of it, and obviously it's the alternative to a petroleum economy. So.
Right. Well, as I say, they say 50,000 uses from a food to face cream to fuel.
That hand cream is very nice. I have a hemp hand cream I use. I like it. I would be entirely hemp woman if I could. But that's what, you know, one of the things we have to look at is, you know, how over time we can. But I think that Indian communities would be the key to starting to pushing for legislation to allow the DEA to pull back from regulating that, recognize tribal sovereignty. And tribes' rights to grow industrial hemp. You know, then they wouldn't have to, you know, I mean, I totally disapprove of the seizure down here in Santa Cruz of the medical marijuana. I disapprove of all that stuff. But, you know, as a start, you know, some of these tribes exercising their sovereignty and jurisdiction and the DEA saying, you go ahead and grow industrial hemp, you go ahead and do economic development.
Isn't that a constant issue, tribal sovereignty?
Yeah.
Who decides? Who's got the power?
Yeah, it's a huge issue for, you know, our communities and in the era of, you know, GATT and these other things. I mean, like these issues around wild rice, you know, or other things. Tribes need to pass resolutions and ordinances that say you cannot mine and take our genetic and biological resources. Those are our properties, and we need to regulate that.
So you say that you're fighting it. Is most of this fighting in court for the struggles around these issues?
The wild rice issue right now is in kind of the public opinion arena. You know, we're going to go and ask the University of Minnesota. It spends millions of dollars on researching paddy rice. There's only 25 paddy rice growers in the whole state of Minnesota. There's 50,000 Ojibwes. Seems kind of like a misuse of public resources to us to do all this work. You know, my position is why don't you just let the University of California do that research, because most of the paddy rice is grown in California anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then we could challenge them on that. But we're...
And probably in other countries too,
right? Paddy rice? Paddy grown wild rice is only grown in California. There is no...
Oh, wild rice we're talking about still.
Yeah, we're talking about that. But the other thing is that the reexamination of the patent is a technical request in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Mm-hmm.
Not in courts. I'm not a big proponent of the courts. You know, I never have been. In the Bush administration, it's worse. But, you know, to be honest with you, Sue, that, you know, in the Supreme Court cases, there's been about 32 cases at the Supreme Court on Indian people, only 2 decisions for and about 30 against. So the Supreme Court has never been good to Indian people.
Yeah. So the struggle continues, that's for sure. That has been going on for 500 years, more than 500 years by now.
Yeah, but, you know, in the face of it, you know, we have communities that are getting back their, you know, sacred items, their songs, their ceremonies, languages, you know, retaining the same way of life, a lot of our practices. And, you know, in the age of globalization, when MTV, Walmart, and, you know, all of that, I think that that is a remarkable thing. And I think there's something to be learned for that. And there is a great deal of hope, you know, in that experience for all of us who wish to keep some integrity of our person in this new millennium.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that the Native American population in the United States is growing. I know that that depends a lot of times on who defines what, how, but...
No, it is hugely growing. I mean, one of the fastest population growths in the country is Native people. And, you know, in a lot of our areas, you know, there's a large flight out of, you know, Caucasian or whatever people out of the region, and a large population growth in Native communities. And the population has doubled and tripled, you know, in a lot of our communities in the past 20 years. Uh-huh. My household, a perfect example. 3 children of my own, 7 children in total in my household. Uh-huh. So only 2 adults. You know, there's a string of adults responsible for those kids, but I tell you what, I know I'm outnumbered by kids by a long shot. So.
Uh-huh. Well, Winona LaDuke, give the webpage again.
Yeah, and... either nativeharvest.org or WELRP.org. It's White Earth Land Recovery Project. Toll-free number 888-779-3577. If you'd like us to send you some flyers on our wild rice campaign to pass out at your food co-ops or your anti-GMO meetings, please give us a holler. You know, we're trying to get the word out on this set of issues. But or other issues in terms of that and energy policy, you know, please give us a holler.
Well, thank you very much, Winona LaDuke, who is the founding director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project, which is in northern Minnesota. And also, she's a writer and most recently has released the Winona LaDuke Reader, which I guess you can probably find at lots of bookstores, right?
We're hoping it is available at a lot of bookstores, plus on the internet, you know, or through our organization. But, you know, it's a compilation of about 20 years of my writing and speeches and testimony at hearings and some poetry and some fiction.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Winona. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.